From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When Bob Dylan stunned the audience at the 1965 Newport Folk Festival by going electric, Joe Boyd was the festival's production manager who oversaw the sound. On today's Fresh Air, Boyd talks about making music in the 60s. He ran a psychedelic music club in London and produced recordings by Pink Floyd, Eric Clapton, the Incredible String Band, Fairport Convention, and Nick Drake. We'll listen with him to some of the great records he's produced. He's written a new memoir called White Bicycles. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Grotesque, a Japanese crime novel published in Japan in 2003 and just translated into English. Maureen describes it as a nasty story about betrayal, bonsai, and bondage. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Joe Boyd's new memoir is subtitled Making Music in the 60s. He didn't play music, but he made it possible for a lot of great musicians to perform and record. He produced recordings by Pink Floyd, Eric Clapton and the Powerhouse, The Incredible String Band, Fairport Convention, Soft Machine, Nico, and Nick Drake, and produced the soundtracks for the films Deliverance and A Clockwork Orange. Boyd is American, but moved to London in the 60s, where he opened a psychedelic music club called UFO. His memoir, White Bicycles, ends in the early 70s, but his music career continued, including founding his own record label, Hannibal. Boyd started off as a jazz and blues concert tour manager in Europe, working for George Wein's production company. He was the production manager at Wein's 1965 Newport Folk Festival, overseeing the sound, when Bob Dylan stunned the crowd by going electric. Here's how Dylan and his band sounded. Joe Boyd, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, what were you thinking about when you did the sound check for the electric part, the plugged-in part of his performance?
Well, that moment on Sunday night was the culmination of a very intense summer and few weeks and few days, building up into a greater and greater level of intensity, of excitement about what Dylan was going to do at Newport. And now we knew, and we were absolutely buzzing. We just were very, very excited about it.
But there were people complaining backstage when the performance actually started that it was too loud?
There were people very involved with the Newport Folk Festival, wonderful, idealistic people who were horrified by what Dylan was doing, who were devastated by the implications of what he was doing. And the manifestation of it that night was volume. It was way too loud. It was the loudest thing anybody had ever heard. It wasn't that loud by today's standards, but I think those people there had never heard anything quite so loud. And Alan Lomax and Theodore Bickel and Pete Seeger were desperate to get the sound turned down.
And did you follow through on their desperate request?
Well, they finally, when realizing they couldn't really get to the sound controls themselves, they asked me to go out there and deliver a message. And as it happened, sitting with Paul Rothschild and Albert Grossman, Dylan's manager at the controls, was Peter Yarrow, who was also a member of the board of the Newport Folk Foundation.
And this is the Peter of Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Yep. And he was loving what was going on. And so when I delivered the message, you've got to turn the sound down, Peter Yarrow said, tell the other members of the board that the board is represented at the sound control, and out here in the audience, this member of the board thinks it sounds fine. And then he extended his middle finger as a little coda, but I did not relay that last part to the three backstage.
So how did you interpret the audience reaction to what Dylan was doing?
Well, there was a lot of noise. You know, I'd grown up occasionally going to the Yankee Stadium and hearing people, when Bill Skowron came up to bat, you know, going moose, 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 because that was his nickname. And you at first thought people were booing. And I felt it was similar, that there was most people were screaming more, 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 because Dylan only did three songs. He was supposed to do 45 minutes, and he only did three songs and then disappeared. And so most of the noise I interpreted as being more. Now, whether they wanted more specifically without the electric band or whether they just wanted more, there were a lot of people who were complaining, who were upset, who were excited. There were fights in the audience. I mean, there was a lot of energy and activity in response to this. And I wouldn't say it was totally rejecting at all.
And that night, did you say to yourself, I have just participated in an important moment of music history?
Absolutely. Everybody knew all weekend that this was a clash of cultures, that this was a shifting of tectonic plates. The culture camp had been manifested all weekend. You know, there was a fist fight between Alan Lomax and Albert Grossman on Saturday afternoon. They tried to ban Grossman from the festival, the old guard of the Newport Folk Foundation. And it was just everywhere in the air, this absolute conflict, which we would, I guess, later call a generational one.
You work with George Wein's folk blues and jazz festivals in the United States and touring through Europe. How did you get from that to moving to London, where you ended up working with a lot of rock, psychedelic, blues, and folk rock bands?
A few weeks after Newport 65, there was George Wein promoted a little folk festival in Connecticut somewhere at a ski resort, and Judy Collins was the featured artist, and Jack Holtzman from Elektra was there. And I had a few too many little plastic cups of wine and sounded off to Holtzman about how pathetic his Elektra Records operation was in England and how the stores didn't stock it because they were too expensive and there was no promotion and what did he think he was doing. And I thought afterwards, oh my God, I really put my foot in my mouth. But about a month later, I got a phone call inviting me for a meeting and inviting me subsequently to go to London and open the Elektra Records office in London.
Well, in England, early on in your stay there, you put together a blues band featuring Eric Clapton and Jack Bruce, along with Steve Winwood, that was, I think you could call it a forerunner of Cream, a band called Eric Clapton and the Powerhouse. How did you help put this band together?
Well, when I was in New York, just before I left for London, I had a lot of meetings, and my friend Paul Rothschild, who'd helped get me the job, who was producing records for Elektra at that time, he was putting together a compilation of electric blues that was going to include The Loving Spoonful and Paul Butterfield and Tom Rush and Al Cooper and a few other people. And I said, don't finish it. Leave a few tracks. When I get to England, I'll sign an English blues band, and it'll be the first transatlantic collaboration inside Elektra. And he said, oh, that's a great idea. And I got to England and was very chagrined to discover that every blues band in the country was basically, of it, that was any good, was signed to a contract with Decca or EMI or somebody. And I was beginning to feel that I'd really embarrassed myself. And I was really lucky because Paul Jones, who was the lead singer for Manfred Mann, walked through the door to try and sell me some other record that he produced himself. And I told him about this project, and he said, oh, you don't need to sign a blues band. We'll just put together an all-star team. And he proceeded to, we made a list on the back of an envelope. And 2 days later, he called me up and said, yeah, they'll all do it, except for Ginger Baker, who's on tour. And we'll get somebody else.
And you had them record the Robert Johnson classic, Crossroads. Why did you choose that?
Well, that's putting it a bit strongly to say that I chose it. The key figures, Paul Jones and Steve Winwood and Eric Clapton, were each going to have a featured song. And Paul and Steve chose their songs, but Clapton hadn't really made up his mind. And so I invited him to come by and chat about it. And I suggested that he had a lot of ideas about Chicago blues that he'd been doing on the road with John Mayall. And I said, well, you know, that seems maybe a bit obvious. What if we took something, an old country blues, and sort of brought it up to Chicago, even though it never made that journey, and sort of toyed with that? And he said, oh, that's a cool idea. And we spent an afternoon playing through our respective record collections of old country blues, and we quickly focused in on Robert Johnson. And he really engineered this combination of a song called Traveling Riverside Blues and Standing at the Crossroads, and stole the guitar riff from one and most of the lyrics and the song structure from the other, and created a classic.
Well, we should hear the results. This was recorded in 1966. Eric Clapton and the Powerhouse, featuring Eric Clapton on guitar, Steve Winwood vocals, Jack Bruce bass, Paul Jones harmonica. And this was produced by my guest Joe Boyd, who's produced a lot of incredible records over the years. And he has a new memoir called White Bicycles about his music-making career in the 1960s. You probably wish that you'd continued to produce Eric Clapton and then Cream.
Well, sure, but you know, you can't, you know, cry over spilt milk. And I think I realized, Eric was, you know, he realized that Elektra at that point was changing. You know, it had been the label of Phil Oakes and Judy Collins and stuff. And Rothschild had really engineered a change. And he'd signed Butterfield, and he signed The Doors and Tim Buckley and Love. And so it was suddenly becoming this kind of hip label. And Clapton was aware of this, and he told me about this group he wanted to put together. And I said, well, you know, what about it, signing for Elektra? He said, well, sure. And then he put me on the phone with his manager, who was this guy called Robert Stigwood, who managed the Bee Gees and, you know, was a big wheeler dealer in the English music business. And within about 30 seconds of the conversation beginning, I knew I was totally out of my depth. And I had no chance of impressing Robert Stigwood. And plus, which Elektra and Jack Holtzman, Jack Holtzman said, well, I didn't think Clapton was that good a guitar player, you know. So.
Well, I hope he ate his words sometime later.
Yeah.
My guest is Joe Boyd. His new memoir is called White Bicycles, Making Music in the 60s. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joe Boyd. His new memoir, White Bicycles, Making Music in the 60s, covers the time when he produced jazz and blues concerts, opened a psychedelic music club in London, and produced records. Well, you went on in London to co-found like a psychedelic music club that also showed movies. Did you feel connected to that psychedelic rock scene, having come out of jazz and blues?
Yeah. London was amazing in 1966, and I had a lot of very good friends who were in something called, you know, I don't know, it was sort of self-titled underground scene in London, and I was a kind of advisor to this thing called the London Free School, which was trying to revolutionize Notting Hill Gate and empower poor people, and at the same time raised money by putting on fundraising events starring Pink Floyd and a light show. And most people who came were kind of, you know, taking various substances. And so I was very involved in that whole world. And it was the most exciting thing going on. I mean, the blues scene of 1964, 65, I could feel was being trumped in a way by what Pink Floyd were doing and Soft Machine and some other groups that were beginning to explore, you know, new ways of making pop music.
Well, you mentioned Pink Floyd. They were kind of like the house band at your club, which was called UFO. And you produced their first single. How did you get to do it?
Well, that's the real disappointment, even a greater disappointment than not signing Cream, because I left Elektra. Jack Holtzman and I agreed to disagree and had one of those "you can't fire me, I quit" conversations. And so I needed to make some money. I needed to figure out a way to support myself in England. And I tried to set up a deal for the Pink Floyd, and I got them a deal with Polydor Records. But an agent got involved, and he said, "Oh, no, no, we can get a better deal at EMI." And in the end, we made the single, Arnold Lane. I produced it for them, and they took it to EMI, and EMI gave them a nice big advance. And in that those days, EMI was a very conservative, old-fashioned company, and they wanted groups to record in their studios with their in-house producers like George Martin. I mean, you know, it worked with the Beatles. It was a pretty good model. You couldn't really argue with them. And so I was kind of left behind as Pink Floyd went forward with EMI.
Well, we should hear the single that you produced. Why don't we hear Arnold Lane? I want you to introduce it to us and tell us why it didn't get airplay at first on the English radio stations.
Well, Arnold Lane, Pink Floyd's first single, written by Syd Barrett, and it's a story that actually resonates with Syd Barrett and Roger Waters, the bass player of Pink Floyd, because they both grew up in Cambridge, and both their mothers took in student boarders. And they early on, they learned that girls were much neater than boys and didn't smell as much and didn't mess up the place. And so they took in girl boarders, students at the local universities. And that meant a lot of lingerie drying after the laundry in the backyard. And there were incidents over the years as they were growing up with items of underclothing going missing. And there was a famous case in Cambridge of somebody who was arrested for stealing these kinds of things. So this song is a tribute to this imaginary character that pilfered the lodger's knickers. And the BBC felt it was just a little bit risque, and they refused to play it.
So here's the record. This is Arnold Lane, Pink Floyd's first single, produced by my guest Joe Boyd, who's written a new memoir called White Bicycles, Making Music in the 1960s.
Arnold Lane had a strange hobby, collecting clothes, moonshine, washing lime. They suit him fine. On the wall hung a toy
Okay, well, Joe Boyd, just before we heard this, you were explaining that the lyric was considered slightly too risque by the BBC. Did it ever get airplay?
I think it got airplay on the pirate ships. It got airplay on Radio Luxembourg, which was a kind of legitimate pirate. And it got some airplay on the BBC before they kind of realized what it was about, and then they kind of stopped it.
Well, you worked with Pink Floyd before they started recording. You produced their first single, and then the band signed with a label, and you didn't produce them anymore. You probably continued to follow their careers, and I wonder what it was like for you to watch Syd Barrett as he started to flip out.
It was very sad. I liked Syd a lot. He was a very bright guy. And one of the things about him was he had these sparkling, dark eyes. And, you know, girls loved him. But the Floyd were very anonymous on stage because they were covered in these dancing lights, these kind of pulsating blobs of light. And so they really didn't project personality much. They were a very anonymous group. And they played at my club. I started this sort of psychedelic ballroom once a week in London called UFO. And they were the house band for the first month and a half or something, and then they played intermittently during the spring. And as they got more and more famous, they played less and less because we couldn't afford them anymore. But they agreed to come back and play one last gig in the summer of 67. By this time, they were huge, and the queues were all the way down the block. I mean, it was a hysterical evening. And I remember there was no artist entrance, so they had to kind of make their way through the crowd, and I was standing by the door watching out for them. And they all came by and said, "Hi, Joe, how you doing?" blah, blah, blah. And the last one to come by was Sid, and I looked, and because of the crush of the crowd, he had to pass really, really close to my face. And I remember looking at him and smiling, and his face was just blank. It was like somebody had reached in and turned off the light. And he went up on stage when they played and just stood there, hardly touched his guitar. And they had to play these long, you know, organ solos and stuff like that because Sid just wasn't touching his guitar. It was really, really devastatingly sad.
Joe Boyd will be back in the second half of the show. His new memoir is called White Bicycles, Making Music in the 60s. Here's a recording Boyd produced by the Incredible String Band. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The bent twig of darkness grows the petals of the morning and shows to them the birds singing just behind the dawning. Come dip into the cloud green.
Support for NPR comes from ThinkMap, maker of the visual thesaurus, an interactive dictionary and thesaurus that helps bring language to life. More at visualthesaurus.com. From the Joyce Foundation, dedicated to protecting the Great Lakes, fresh water at the heart of America, joycefdn.org. And from Bantam Books, publisher of The Power of a Positive No, How to Say No and Still Get to Yes, by William Urey, author of Getting Past No. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Joe Boyd tells the story behind producing this record, Dueling Banjos, his biggest hit, which he didn't even like. But he loved producing Nick Drake, which he'll talk about too. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a nasty Japanese crime novel. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Joe Boyd. His new memoir about making music in the 60s is called White Bicycles. It covers the period when Boyd produced jazz and blues concerts, opened a psychedelic music club in London, and produced recordings by Pink Floyd, Eric Clapton and the Powerhouse, the Incredible String Band, Fairport Convention, Soft Machine, Nico, and Nick Drake. After your psychedelic club, the UFO, closed, you brought together Sandy Denny, the singer, with the band The Fairport Convention, and a really important folk rock group came together. And before we go on with this, I want you to explain what you think their importance was in the history of folk rock.
Well, the phrase, in the history of folk rock, I think there are probably listeners out there whose hearts are sinking right now as we're speaking. And I assure them, don't turn that dial. It's not that bad. The F word has a lot to answer for, I think. But there was a moment in the 60s where the Fairport Convention and maybe a few other groups like Pentangle and Incredible String Band, that was another group that I was involved with, made it kind of hip to mix a kind of popular attitude and, you know, popular musical forms with traditional English folk music. And this came about in a way, in a curious way, with the Fairport, because they were, when Sandy joined the Fairport, Richard Thompson was the lead guitar player. And that combination was incredible. I mean, that was one of the great privileges I had as a record producer, to work in the studio with a group containing those two people at the same time. It was fantastic. And the group was developing a style which was really quite American, quite based on American sort of West Coast rock and folk singer-songwriters and stuff like that. And they had a terrible accident, and the drummer, Martin Lamble, was killed. And their first idea was to disband, never play again. And then they thought, well, if we were going to play again, we could never play the songs we played with Martin. We just couldn't do it. So maybe we'll do something else, completely new repertoire. And that spring of 69, there was a record that every musician in London had. You used to see them walking down the street under people's arms, all over King's Road and Notting Hill Gate. It was music from Big Pink by the Band. And that record hit like an atom bomb. It was just so powerful as a record. And I think it cured the Fairport of any ideas that they might have of doing an American repertoire, because the Band was so American and so great, and they did it with such a fantastic attitude, that it closed that door. They just couldn't go there anymore. It was just a waste of time. And then I think they got the idea, well, maybe what we could do is do something that's as English as the Band is American. And they started going down to Cecil Sharp House, which is the archive of the English Folk Dance and Song Society, and researching all these old ballads and things, and came up with this record called Legion Leaf, which was recently voted the most influential folk album of all time in Britain or something like that. And it was a fantastic project. It was a very, very exciting time.
Well, I want to play a track from the album that you just mentioned, and this is called The Deserter, and this is a traditional song from the British Isles?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And anything you want us to listen for on it?
Well, the drumming is fantastic, I think, and Sandy's performance as a vocalist, and just the whole ensemble. I think, to me, it's funny, I'd just kind of forgotten about this, and when I was putting together the compilation to go with the book, I went back and listened to Legion Leaf, and much to my astonishment, I said, that's the best track on the record. I've completely forgotten about this track. It's great.
Well, let's hear it. This is The Deserter, Fairport Convention, produced in 1969 by my guest, Joe Boyd.
Next I deserted, I thought myself free, until my cruel sweetheart informed against me. I was quickly followed after and brought back with speed. I was handcuffed and guarded, heavy irons put on me. Court-martial, then quickly was got, and the sentence passed upon me that I was to be shot. May the Lord have mercy on them for their sad cruelty, for now the Queen's duty lies heavy on me.
That's Fairport Convention with singer Sandy Denny. recorded in 1969 and produced by my guest, Joe Boyd, who's written a memoir about producing concerts and records in the 1960s. It's called White Bicycles. Well, let me get to another really important set of recordings that you made, and I'm thinking here of Nick Drake. And when you produced Nick Drake in, what, the late 60s and early 70s, he had a very teeny audience, virtually, you know, hardly any record sales, and he's since become incredibly influential, this, like, cult following. One of his records was recently used on a VW commercial. I'm sure you never imagined, well, maybe I'm not so sure that you never imagined all of that would happen, but let's back up. How did you first start working with Nick Drake?
A member of the Fairport Convention heard Nick Drake at a benefit concert, an anti-Vietnam War protest concert. And he just came into the office and handed me this piece of paper with a phone number, and he said, call this guy, he's pretty interesting. And I called Nick, and he came in and brought me a tape. Later that day, I put the tape on, and from the first 15 seconds into that tape, I was mesmerized. I just thought, where is this coming from? This is amazing. This is completely unlike. I mean, I'd heard a lot of singer-songwriters with guitar. This was so different and so unusual and so sophisticated and so, I don't know, just hard to describe how the qualities that it had. It was so literate and so full of influences, but mysterious influences that you couldn't put your finger on. Anyway, so I made a record with him. And then that didn't sell. Nobody bought it, much to both of our horror. And then I made another record. And then after that record, which had a lot of other musicians, John Cale did arrangements on some things, and I left to move to California, and Nick insisted on making his third record completely alone, just guitar and voice. And I thought he was mad. I thought his last chance of ever having a success is gone now because he's willfully turned his back on anything kind of commercial. But I believed always that Nick's music would get through. And when I sold my production company, I put a clause in the contract that Island Records had to keep Nick Drake's records in the catalog at all times, no matter if they never sold a copy. They could never be deleted. That was in the contract. And Chris Blackwell from Island, to his credit, he didn't need any convincing. He agreed to that immediately because he loved Nick as well. And I always believed that one day people would get it. And it's just tragic that they got it after he died, long after he died. But Nick has the last laugh, of course, because of all the three records, the best-selling record is Pink Moon, the one that he did on his own with no arrangements. And the one that I was proudest of, that I felt, you know, was one of my triumphs as a record producer, sells the least.
And which one is that?
Brighter Later.
My guest is Joe Boyd. His new memoir, White Bicycles, Making Music in the 60s, has just been published. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joe Boyd. His new memoir, White Bicycles, Making Music in the 60s, covers the period when he produced jazz and blues concerts, opened a psychedelic music club in London, and produced records. When we left off, we were talking about discovering and producing Nick Drake. You know, you've put together a personal anthology of some of the recordings that you talk about in your book, and you feature Nick Drake's Way to Blue. It's a really beautiful track. Tell us why this one is special to you.
I wanted to make what I considered a world-class first record with Nick. And so the first thing I did was hire the string arranger who'd made the arrangements for James Taylor's first record for Apple. And Nick and I both were very disappointed. We just didn't think it worked. And Nick then said, well, I have a friend at Cambridge who's done some arrangements for me. I've performed with a string quartet. And he's not bad. And Nick was so diffident and so, I don't know, so hesitant to put himself forward that when he actually said something like this, I thought, well, I better check this guy out. And I met Robert Kirby and invited him to do an arrangement. And I didn't even know the song because Nick didn't play it on the guitar. It was just voice and strings. And we came into the studio and Robert started running down all the string parts separately, individually, and the engineer getting the sound individually. And I was so tantalized by this because they sounded really interesting and wonderful lines. And finally, Nick started singing. All the strings came up in the control room together, mixed beautifully. And it was just fantastic. I almost wept. It was so beautiful. I just thought, this is it. This is great.
So let's hear it. This is Nick Drake, recorded in 1969, Way to Blue, produced by my guest Joe Boyd.
Don't you have a word to show what may be done? Have you never heard the way to find the sun? Tell me all that you may know. Show me what you have to show. Won't you come and say if you know the way to blue? Have you seen the land?
That was the late Nick Drake, recorded in 1969, produced by my guest Joe Boyd, who's written a new memoir about his work producing concerts and recordings in the 60s. It's called White Bicycles. Just a few years after this recording was made, Nick Drake died in what was officially called a suicide. You question whether it was actually a suicide.
I don't know. You know, it's very hard to say. He was taking antidepressants, and this was the very early years of antidepressants. And I know that the doses were very, very high in those days compared to what they are now. And I know that there are cases where antidepressants can make people roller coaster, you know, go very elated one minute and very depressed the next. And he evidently was very, very excited and elated like a few days before he died. And I don't know, I suppose I'm just tempted by the scenario that he plunged into an abyss of some kind and decided he needed to take more of these pills that had made him feel so elated a few days before. But you'll never know. There's no note, there's no evidence.
You know, we've heard some really terrific music that you've produced, and you know, you've told stories about how you didn't get the opportunity to continue with the people whose careers you started. Some of these recordings weren't appreciated in their own time, and so on and so on. A huge hit that you had is something that apparently you didn't even like, and I'm thinking of Dueling Banjos from the soundtrack of Deliverance. Just tell us the story of how you came to do this and how it became to be a hit in spite of what you thought of it.
Well, I was running this production company in London called Witch Season Productions, and it was just, as you say, I mean, we had a lot of frustrations. We had a lot of records that people liked but that didn't sell, and we were in debt, and the whole thing was spinning out of control. And in the middle of all of this, I got an offer from Warner Brothers to come to California and take charge of film music. And I thought, oh boy, I need a break. I'd like to learn something new. I'd like to live in Laurel Canyon and, you know, have a sybaritic few years after the stresses and strains of keeping this company together in England and all these crazy artists who don't sell. So off I go, and I take charge of the film music. And one of my first tasks was to meet with a director called John Boorman, who was working on a project called Deliverance. And he had been traveling in a car in the South, scouting locations and listening to the local country music radio. And he'd heard this song, and he'd actually had the presence of mind to tape. He had a little tape recorder, and he turned on the tape recorder and taped the last bit of this song and then tracked it and identified it. And he said, Here it is. It's called Dueling Banjos. And this is what I want to make as part of the essential element in the soundtrack. And he had a scene that he wanted somebody, an actor, to play the banjo and play that tune. And he said, okay, can you get the best guy to do it? And I immediately knew the best guy to do it was called Bill Keith, who was the man who invented the Scruggs peg, who ghost wrote Earl Scruggs' book about how to play the banjo, who'd been a friend of mine in Harvard Square in the early 60s. And I got a hold of Bill, and he was touring in Ireland trying to learn how to play the pedal steel guitar. And he'd met a girl, and he didn't want to come back for the session. He said, get Eric Weisberg to do it. You know, how much is involved here, $2,000? I'm not coming back for that. And so I called up Eric Weisberg, who I also knew, and Eric said, sure. And we went down to Georgia, and we recorded Dueling Banjos, backwards, forwards, fast, upside down, slow, every kind of which way. And Boorman was delighted and used all of that stuff in the movie. You hear all of that stuff Eric did up, you know, when they're rowing down the river and everything. Anyway, and the key moment is when the banjo player and the guitar player from two different cultures meet in the middle of the backwoods and they play this duet. And Boorman thought, this is going to be a huge hit. The record company absolutely refused, wouldn't put it out as a single, said, you're joking, this is nonsense. And they gave him some promo copies. And he played it on a radio station in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And the next day, the record company had an order for 5,000 copies from the Minneapolis branch. And the rest is history.
And you were surprised?
We were all astonished. Everybody at the record company and me.
You know, I regret we only have time to cover your career in the 60s. There's so many more records that you made after that that would really be fun to play and talk about. Before we have to end, I'm just wondering, you know, you're interested in so many different kinds of music, blues, jazz, rock, folk rock, psychedelic, and you've done so much. How do you think of yourself as fitting in to music history? I mean, where do you see yourself fitting in as a producer?
Well, I don't think producers make history. I mean, I think I like to think my ambition, as stated in the book, when I set out, was to be an eminence grise, some shadowy figure in the background. And I think I've succeeded in doing that. And it's quite nice to be, you know, shafts of light occasionally coming back into the, you know, as I step forward a little bit by writing a book. But I always had a sense of history. Before I even did anything in the music business, I listened endlessly to records from the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, from all over the world, from all different genres. And everything I did, I always had somewhere in the back of my mind this little voice saying, does that deserve to belong on that shelf with all those other great records you have in your collection? And I always had that sense of perspective. That's why I tried not to make records that were too contemporary or too trendy or too had a sound that was too identified with a particular era. So if I end up on sort of nerdy record collecting kids' shelves in future, you know, if they put my records up there alongside some of the great records from the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, that'll make me very happy. That's how I see myself.
Joe Boyd, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you so much, and thank you for the great music.
Thank you.
Joe Boyd's new memoir is called White Bicycles, Making Music in the 60s. Here's one of the jazz recordings he produced, featuring Chris McGregor and the Brotherhood of Breath. Coming Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a newly translated crime novel by a celebrated Japanese writer. This is Fresh Air. Celebrated Japanese crime writer Natsuo Kirino made her American debut in 2005 when her novel Out was translated into English and became a finalist for an Edgar Award. Out told the weird story of an abused wife who strangles her husband and then seeks the aid of her co-workers at a boxed lunch factory in covering up the murder. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan says that novel was a sensation not simply because it lured American readers out of the tourist precincts of Japan, but because of its distinctive worldview and tone. Another Kirino novel, Grotesque, has just been translated into English. Maureen has this review.
Natsuo Kirino helps us aficionados of crime fiction imagine the kind of novels James M. Cain might have written if he had been a Japanese feminist. That same greasy smog of despair that hovers over the housing-tract wastelands of Mildred Pierce and Double Indemnity blankets the fringes of Kirino's Tokyo. Like Cain, Kirino is a big believer in fate, not as an agent of deliverance, but as the ultimate dead end to all possibilities, especially for women. Kirino also reminds me of Cain in that she's not afraid to go over the top. She spins out almost cartoonish plots about wildly twisted personalities and laughable lusts that turn deadly. If crime noir is a genre that's distinguished by its courage in exploring the outermost suburbs of the human psyche, then Kirino, like Cain, fills up the tank, puts the pedal to the metal, and takes us readers on a long drive into the night without safety belts. Out, the first novel of Kirino's to be translated into English, has just been published in paperback to coincide with the publication of a new hardback crime novel by Kirino called Grotesque. Grotesque first came out in Japan in 2003. It's been translated from the Japanese by Rebecca Copeland, who should have received combat pay for that job because the story it tells for nearly 500 pages is emotionally harrowing. Here are the bare bones of the tale. Two middle-aged prostitutes named Yuriko and Kazue have been murdered in Tokyo. The murders are sensational because both women were graduates of the same prestigious girls' high school. When the novel opens, their murderer, an illegal Chinese immigrant, has been arrested and put on trial. Case closed. Except the murders are really just excuses for our narrator, the older sister of Yuriko, to begin a bitter retrospective about her childhood and, most of all, the monstrous beauty of her sister. Yes, I said monstrous because one of the things Grotesque does so elegantly is make a reader recognize how aberrant and disturbing great beauty is. Yuriko and our narrator share the same parents. Their mother was Japanese, their father a Polish businessman in Japan to peddle cheap Swiss chocolates. While Yuriko is a knockout, our narrator, her older sister, is drab, and so much in Yuriko's shadow that she doesn't even rate a first name throughout this book. But save your pity. As our narrator says, thanks to Yuriko, I too had been blessed with a certain talent. My talent was the uncompromising ability to feel spite. What follows from that admission is a nasty story about incest and betrayal, bonsai and bondage, that readers have been given fair warning to take with a grain of salt, or better yet, a dose of antibiotics. While Yuriko's venomous older sister is our primary narrator, we also hear from other voices, courtesy of Yuriko's posthumously unearthed diary, letters from classmates of the girls, and the court testimony of the Chinese national accused of the murders. At the quicksand center of Grotesque is the story of the cutthroat competition that marks daily life at Kyu High School, the elite private girls' school that Yuriko, Kazue, the other murder victim, and our narrator attended. It's a place where the student hierarchies are sealed into place on the first day of classes. Girls who aren't from wealthy families might exhaust themselves, as our narrator did, in the struggle to excel in their studies. Other girls, like Sad Sack Kazue, desperately attempt to compete by stitching fake Ralph Lauren logos onto their knee socks and gluing on thin plastic wands called Elizabeth eyelids in order to achieve the desired Western eye fold. All for naught. The attributes that give women the most power in this man's world are her father's money or her own beauty, such as the fabulous, boundary-breaking beauty that was possessed by Yuriko. That's a rather harsh view of things, of course, and surely a fantastically successful writer like Natsue Kirino is not asking us to believe that these days a woman's face is her fortune. But in Grotesque, as in all great crime noir, under the heaping mounds of operatic passion and hyperbolic social commentary, lays the shriveled corpse of a buried truth, perhaps still shallowly breathing.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed the novel Grotesque by Japanese crime writer Natsuo Kirino. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Virginia Woolf's early novel, Night and Day, in stores and online at bn.com. From TIAA CREF, helping those who serve others plan for and live in retirement, online at tiaacref.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the past, present, and future of nuclear weapons. Non-proliferation expert Joseph Cirincione evaluates the situations in North Korea and Iran and considers what can be done to control the nuclear threat worldwide. He has a new book called Bomb Scare. Join us for the next Fresh Air.